Well, I started, this is my second tour of duty with Microsoft. I started with them back in January of 1990 when I left the Army, and came in there, worked on OS 2, worked on the operating system stuff, the release of Windows 3.0, and then started work in the dev tool space back in 92. And so I've worked on Microsoft development tools since about 1992. I left Microsoft Australia for a few years, and Microsoft US hired me to come work here in Redmond, and I started here on the 11th of May, 1998. This is the beautiful thing, you know, when I, you know, right at the height of the dot-com boom, we were had a lot of people, you know, going off, joining, you know, Silicon Valley companies, that sort of thing, and so to keep people around or bring people back, they said that if you come back, they'll give you back your seniority. So you kept the years that you'd previously served. I looked at them and I said, well, you know, if you really wanted to make me happy, you'd give me the stock options I forgave. But they, no, we want this to be cost-free. So they gave me my effective hire date for the U.S. position is November 10th, 1993. So I've been here almost 16 years, according to the effective hire date. Well, Visual J++ was the market-leading Java development tool of its time. It was a development tool that we built back in, I think the first release was in 97, where we signed a license with Sun to go and build a Java development tool. And we wanted to build a great dev tool to build Windows applications in using Java. And that was sort of the focus of Visual J++. The interesting thing about VJ++ is that a lot of the core technologies in terms of the IDE, the integrated development environment that we actually built for that product, we've taken through into Visual Studio today. Our IDE today is a thing that devs would know called devenv.exe. Well, devenv.exe was the IDE from the Visual J++ product set. So I started work on the Visual J++ team here, and I was actually working on a product, on a future release of Visual J++. It was going to be Visual J++ 7. The code name for that was Landshark. We sat around trying to come up with a good code name. I wanted to call it Bruce. They wouldn't let me. So we settled on Landshark. That's a little, you know, Monty Python humor if you've ever seen the Bruce episodes. We ended up calling it Landshark, and it was slated for release after Visual J++ 6. VJ6 shipped in 98, and just after we shipped 6.0, while we were working all on that, Sun sued us over violation of the Java TLDA, I think they called it, the Technical Licensing and Distribution Agreement. And we lost an injunction court thing, and so they, you know, said no to shipping that. So at the end of 98, we were in Sun Valley, and we were all having dinner, and then they came in and sort of told us, okay, you know, those of you on the right-hand side of the table, you still have products. Those of you on the left-hand side of the table, feel free to go work on something else. So we, you know, had to find out, we found out that we couldn't ship it, and then, you know, we had to go and work on, you know, what is the next thing we're going to build, you know. So that was why I say it was litigated out from under me. In no uncertain terms, it pissed me off. A Sun executive once said, you know, that we don't, Microsoft doesn't write stupid contracts, but other parties certainly sign them. And he was absolutely correct. You know, I think the whole thing was a travesty, really. We went out there and we built a great Windows development tool, and really focused on what customers wanted to. You know, the Sun guys, they viewed Java as a way of hurting Microsoft and selling hardware. And we view Java as simply another programming language. You know, let's go make a great Windows development tool. And we did. At one point there, Visual J++, you know, owned 80-odd percent of the Java development space. 89% of all Java applications built were Windows-specific apps. We knew we wanted to deliver a tool in the same developer space that Visual J++ really provided a set of attributes for customers in. And so we sat down and we started thinking about, well, what are the attributes of, you know, of a modern programming language do we need to think about? And so we looked at what you know, C++ had. We looked at what functional programming languages had. We looked at what Java offered, and this sort of thing. And so we said, okay, you know, we have a pretty good idea of what customers liked about the language, what they wouldn't like about, you know, a language. And we sat down and started work on building or designing a new language. At the same time that was going on, we had a bunch of guys working on building the next generation of the COM Plus platform, which was the Component Object Model Plus, I guess, another in the great line of wonderfully named Microsoft products. We are the company that bought you the Internet Security Acceleration Server, 2005 Service Pack 2, Release 1. They started work on the COM Plus, the next version of the COM Plus runtime, and dealing with a lot of the problems that had existed for customers in that previous version, in the previous platform. And we melded those two together, and eventually we came up with a product, a language called C#, and a framework that is now known as the .NET framework, a runtime engine. You know, and they're built around a set of frameworks and a thing called the CLR, or the Common Language Runtime. So I basically stopped work on J++ and pretty much just started work, you know, flipped over the wall and went to work on that project. Yeah. We were a tad loose with the rules back then, yes. Well, like any big company, you know, the culture at Microsoft, just like any big company, has evolved over the years. You know, when I first started at Microsoft Australia, I was, you know, the 42nd employee in the subsidiary. I was about the 25th or 26,000th employee Microsoft worldwide. And now, you know, we've got, you know, 75, 80, 90, 200, who knows, how many tens of thousands of employees. And as you grow in size, you know, culture changes. You know, we took a much, you know, looser sort of attitude to what things would, you know, what was good, what was bad. There was a lot more, you know, fun involved in the whole process. I remember back in 92, I think it was, we were at the Professional Developer Conference, the first time we rolled out Windows NT, and we went out, you know, drinking with a bunch of the guys from Borland, and, you know, they bought us a bunch of beers, and I'm standing there having a good time chatting to these guys, and suddenly somebody taps me on the shoulder and says, come on, we got to go. I'm like, oh, you know, okay. And I wander off, and then we get outside, and then it's run. I'm like, run? What? Run. So we took off down the road, and it was, as we're running, I'm like, you know, why are we running? And they said, well, we just stiffed balling with the bar tab. So we had, you know, they then came back and were asking, you know, they asked us to pay it, and, you know, there's big laughs and all that sort of stuff. Turns out, 7 years later, I think I work for the guy who we stiffed with the bar tab, who came to work at Microsoft. I'm like, ooh, you know, but we did a lot of fun stuff. You know, just random things. You know, like playing. You know, you would go and do presentations, and you would have a word of the day. You would have to get into your presentation, and you had to use it in a way that wasn't gratuitous. You know, It wasn't like the word you might be given was theodolite, and you couldn't just randomly say theodolite. What you could say would be something like an integrated development environment like Visual Studio is as important to a developer as a theodolite is to a surveyor. You know, and so you would try and fit that in and all this sort of stuff. We did a few other, you know, things. You know, we had, you know, and it wasn't just really us. I'm sort of thinking, well, what can I say and what can't I say? The competition was fierce amongst all of the players, but, you know, everyone sort of had a bit of a laugh about it, you know, and it was a very interesting environment. You know, being a Microsoft employee in the early 90s and the late 90s, you know, being at Microsoft wasn't really a career choice so much as it was a lifestyle statement. Well, we were very, examples of the lifestyle, you know, statement with things. So we were a very young team. A lot of us, you know, a lot of us were single. We would go out and there'd be a lot of, you know, you would work your 15 hours and then you'd finish up. It's okay, meet me at the bar, and you'd go out and you'd party together, and then you'd, you know, come back the next day, work. No one ever complained about the investment of time and effort. And, you know, when you went on the road to conferences and things like that, it was, you know, a great chance for you to go out and have some fun and, you know, chat to customers and bring them in and have fun with them as well, and all this sort of stuff. You know, now the corporation is much more of like, you know, we need to be sort of wearing our three-piece business suit and, you know, have our tie done correctly, and, you know, it's yes sir, no sir, three bags full sir, you know, and it's just a bit of a change, you know, but you expect it. You know, companies have to grow. You have to, the products you build are more complex. It takes longer to do things. Customers are investing more money and they want things to work. They would prefer that we spent time fixing bugs in our product than putting in, you know, what they did in, I think, Excel, you know, 95, which was they put a Doom simulator in the help system. You know, they want us to fix bugs. Don't spend time building that sort of thing, you know. You know, I think there should be a mix of stuff. You know, I think the beholding to the business concept of a staid corporation is something that limits the creativity of people. You know, I'm not saying that, you know, that the whole of Microsoft campus should devolve into a 70,000 person frat house, but it should definitely have a better attitude and a much more, you know, it's sort of a fun attitude around the whole concept. We still have a lot of fun, but it's, you know, it's we're leaning, that pendulum is swinging back over to the business side of stuff, you know, and it might swing back if we're still employed after the recession. Primary development tools that existed for customers were C++, or in fact C was really the language. There was MacroAssembler, there was Borland's Turbo Pascal, and then there was the XBase realm, the whole DBase, Fox Pro, so on and so forth. Those tools had uniquely different characteristics, you know, and the basic development tools that existed were very simple. They had an accessible language that made it easy for people to do stuff. If you wanted quickly executing code, or you wanted to do something that was very complex and needed a power in the language, you would use C. If you wanted ease of access, you would use BASIC. And then we started to see windowing operating systems appearing. You know, the primary ones were Presentation Manager and OS 2, Mac OS on the Apple machines, and Windows coming out. And so as people wanted to build these graphical applications, they started having to do a lot of work to get these done. And so we introduced a product that was codenamed Thunder at the time, in the late 1990-91 period, codenamed Thunder, that eventually became Visual Basic. And it was around delivering the ease of the Visual Basic language and the visual composition ability of having a design surface and dragging and dropping things. And it kicked off the whole market behind rapid application development. And people started sort of looking and saying, okay, well, now I can rapidly build my Windows applications. And if I need power, well, then I'm going to have to use C. And then the C++ language came along, which is an evolution of the C language. And the C++ guys started saying, well, you know, I'm building these Windows apps, so I want some visual composition as well. So they started seeing some of the rapid application aspects come through. And I think in 93, 94, somewhere around there, I'd have to, you know, go and pop my head into the museum and have a look. But somewhere around there, we released Visual C++ 1.0. And it provided this visual design environment, the visual composition aspect for C++ customers. And we've seen over time that those two tools, Visual Basic and the Visual C++ tools, have gotten sort of closer in terms of the visual design abilities. And the languages themselves have evolved. You know, the object-oriented development capabilities that were in C++ started to migrate into Visual Basic. Some of the simplicity of how Visual Basic dealt with things started to migrate into, not into C++ language, but into our frameworks that we built around it, things like the Microsoft Foundation classes and the Active Template libraries and so on, MFC and ATL for most people. And then that's where sort of Java and the Visual J++ product came in at a side, as an attempt to sort of, you know, give a powerful language and an ease of use and ease of design that didn't exist in each of those two languages by themselves. The ease of interaction between, or integration between, the two languages. You know, one of the challenges that a Visual Basic programmer had when they first started using the product was that they would grow their system to a point where they needed to do something in Windows. They needed to tell the operating system itself, okay, I've got to go and do this. At that point, it was hard to do that in Visual Basic. So you would go and do it using, but it was easy to do in C++ and C. So you would have somebody that would have to write a component or a library or a DLL inside, you know, C and C++, and then the Visual Basic people would have to call it. There were a lot of challenges with that. You know, firstly, the way you call a procedure or a subroutine or in Visual Basic is much different from the way you do it in native languages like C++, MASM, and so on. So you had to do marshalling to get those to work, and that was a lot of work for people to do this. This is why, you know, as we did VB1 and VB2, we came out with the control library ability, you know, and so people could go, third-party customers would go and build controls, and these controls would do common tasks, and they'd package them up and sell them in their community. Visual Basic developers would buy those controls, put them in their applications, and use them to do things. Like a great example would be tooltips. You know, you couldn't do tooltips in VB at one point, but there are a number of ways you could do it in native languages in Windows. So you would go out there and buy a control that would do all the work to unpack the window that was the control in VB and then display a tooltip for you. Or you wanted to do network access, you know, doing FTP and HTTP work inside Visual Basic was somewhat challenging. So you would go and buy an FTP or SMTP library and a set of controls that you would then drag and drop and write some basic code in it. And this was one of the things that we wanted to do as we moved into the .NET world, was to sort of unify these two models so that a Visual Basic developer could use a tool that they were familiar with and use a language they were familiar with to go and build pretty much everything they needed to, and then could call Windows in a way that was straightforward to them. What were devs asking for in sort of the 1990, 91, 92, 93 era? A lot of it was, surprisingly, they wanted to be able to build Windows applications rapidly. And it wasn't necessarily Windows applications. They wanted graphical user interfaces because that was the way the market was going to. And to do that, they needed to get they needed some way to interact with the operating system. And so a lot of devs were clamoring for an easy way for them to build these Windows apps. Another group was saying that, you know, I want an easy way to build database applications. You know, how do I go and easily take a set of data, manipulate it, and surface that data inside my application? And then a third set of customers were saying, well, you know, I need performance, scalability, the sort of the classic ility aspect of things. And they wanted tooling support to make that work, which was at the time inherently costly, much, much better. So those sort of three areas were what people were really trying to deal with. You have to put that in the context that back in, even in the 90s, when the PC was pretty much well established and the whole, you know, companies were buying PCs for their organizations and so on, the development sort of space was still very much driven by central IT that was used to the mainframe model of, you know, I will generate 7 screens for you and that will happen in 9 months and you will be happy that those 7 screens will do what I want them to do. You know, the responsiveness from central IT to customers, to their internal customers, and how accurately those things reflected the needs of the internal customers were often, you know, almost non-existent. And so people started seeing this processing power on the desktop, but really no advantage to having it because development was still controlled in the central IT world. And you saw a lot of people grasp on to things like Visual Basic and the database product, Microsoft Access, around that same time, because it enabled them to build solutions in the control of their area. Now, that turned out to be sometimes very, very bad for those applications. A lot of people would start building an application for their department, for example, and it's supposed to be for the 10 people in their department. And then, a senior manager would come along and go, oh, this is a great idea. Let's roll this out to my entire department. And suddenly an app that was built by somebody who was not a professional developer focused on handling 10 people suddenly now had to handle 1,000 people in the department. And you saw some great stuff, some classic problems that rolled out like that across all aspects, all verticals, all different types of businesses. When we shipped Windows NT back in, before we shipped Windows NT, I worked as a consultant for Microsoft to a bank. It was sort of I complained, therefore I volunteered type thing. And I spent 4 months with them through the Windows NT evaluation process. It turned out that one of their applications was that controlled a substantial portion of their business was written by one of their accountants using DBase, and it ran on an MS-DOS machine connected to a Novell NetWare server with this database, and it ran. It was just simply sort of evolutionarily grown from his need to combine things, and they were having problems with scalability, and it was they basically ran into an issue where they couldn't do any more business because the processing window. They could only start processing when the bank stopped serving customers, and it had to be ready when the bank started serving customers had to be finished by the time the bank started serving. So that 12-hour processing window was now exceeded in terms of the amount of work. And they were like, well, what the hell do we do? This complaint against Central IT, Central IT would stand up there, if you let us build it, we would have built it properly, and it would scale and be perfect and would cure cancer and there'd be no more world hunger. And the reality is that Central IT was not necessarily better, but they certainly were more process-oriented and certainly thought through some of the larger aspects that the departmental people didn't. So where did Visual Studio come from? That's an interesting question. A lot of people, when we first rolled out Visual Studio, said, so you work on something like Photoshop? And it'd be, no, we don't work on Photoshop. It is a development tool. And people go, well, what's a development tool? Nature's way of telling you that you've sort of, hosed yourself in terms of product naming when people can look at your name and go, okay, I have absolutely the wrong idea for what your product does. If you go back, it's actually an interesting thing. In the software industry, if you start back in sort of 93, 94, it's surprising enough, Microsoft Australia, we put together, Microsoft used to sell Excel, Word, PowerPoint, and one other thing, I can't think of what it is. We used to sell those as separate products. And our office product manager at Microsoft Australia said, we can put them together, wrap a box around them, and sell them at a discount. And they came up with this idea of Microsoft Office that was wildly successful in our market. And the US adopted the whole idea and really went and excelled. The Office team has done an awesome job on Microsoft Office as an integrated set of tools. Well, you do that in one area of Microsoft, and every man and his dog suddenly has to be a bundle of things, much like when we launched the .NET name. Pretty much every group at Microsoft had to have product name .NET. You were seeing Word .NET coming out. You were seeing Windows .NET. At one point there, we cut it off when we started to expect that we were going to get the joystick people saying, hey, I've produced Sidewinder.net. But, the idea was really a great idea. And so back prior to 97, about 96, early 96, the guys got together and said, well, we have a bunch of these separate development environments. We should put them together because customers are starting to use more and more tools. And our research showed us, we'd done a lot of research that said that something like 67 or 70% of developers used more than one language to build their application. So people were acquiring our products piecemeal. We said, well, let's bring them all together and sell in a single group. And that became Visual Studio 97 that we sent out there. It was more of a bundling thing than an actual integrated product. Back in 97, we had three different development environments. We had MS Dev, which was the C++ product. We had Ruby, which was the Visual Basic Design Surface and framework combined. And we had DevEnv. We had Visual C++, Visual Basic, Visual Fox Pro, Visual InterDev. That's another great naming product. Greg Leake owns that one, but that was the last time we let a senior exec actually pick a name. And Visual J++. And so the naming is one of my pet peeves. It's the C-sharp, getting the name, I worked to get the name C-sharp, and that was an eight-month tour through the darkness of human nature when it comes to product naming. We got we put those together, and so the change between 97 and then the 98, the 5.0 to 6.0 product range, we started looking much more of how we could bring an integration together between things. So let's get to one IDE, let's make things consistent, let's have the same debug information in the different products, all this sort of thing. So 97 was more of a product from us that reflected our customers' needs to have multiple tools. 98 was a refinement of that, and then 2002 was an actual culmination of bringing everything together to be a single product so that you could transfer information from language developer to other language developer. Well, remember how I said that, you know, we had a lot of fun. You know, 98 to 2002 was very much like our lost years at college. You know, we experimented, met with, industry people who we'd never be seen with in public, that sort of thing. What we actually did in that period was to undergo a wholesale redevelopment of our platform, our developer toolset. And people seem to think, they look at Microsoft and they say, okay, you guys are this enormous company. You're this monolithic organization and you have unlimited resources. And the reality is that we don't have unlimited resources. You know, we have, compared to small companies, yes, we have a lot of resources. But the products we build are large and complex. For example, Visual Studio today has over 40 million lines of code in it. That's a lot of investment and takes a lot of work for people to go and build these things. So, in that sort of period from 98 through to 2002, we developed a language, C#. We developed a framework and a runtime, the Common Language Runtime, and the base framework that became the .NET framework. We implemented the whole model of web service support in our stuff. We did a lot of work with the standardization bodies to go and get stuff in terms of non-Microsoft interoperability aspects of those things. And we melded all those disparate languages that we had and development experiences onto a single tool set. That just takes time. It just takes time to go and build something of that size. And that's basically what we did in that period. Now, we didn't just go dark. I think in 2000, I was in Orlando five times that year as we did different conferences to talk about it. In one period there, I did 50,000 miles of flying in 7 weeks with carry-on luggage only and two pairs of shoes, just to be clear, which were less shoes than our PR people brought with them. But we did a lot of stuff from 2000 onwards as we talked about the new platform and why you should do it. We rolled out pre-releases and things like this. It wasn't that we were dark, but it just takes time. And we released in 2002, we released in 2003, we released in 2005, 2008, and now we're working on the next version. Oh, I've had some... getting involved in a good flame war was cathartic at times. We're not that company anymore. But the funny thing about the whole flame war concept was that flaming in and of itself isn't bad. Flaming when you're wrong is really bad. So as long as you're always right, you can sort of flame away. And so I've had a few cases where the flaming that occurred between us... And I actually think it's the world's best flaming story, but I don't know if you want it for the video. The flaming that occurs, as long as you're right, you sort of get let off about the whole thing. Now we're a much more sort of professional company, and that we have to we should be respectful of other people's opinions, and things like that. So I've completely internalized that thing. I think everyone has a right to an opinion, no matter how incorrect it may be. When we were launching 2002, we held a thing we call the Professional Developers Conference, and people would come along to the PDC, and they're coming along to hear about our new platform. And we were pitching everyone, this is enterprise-quality software, you can bet your business on this, blah, blah, blah. And our major competitor was a technology from Sun and other Java vendors like IBM called J2EE. Well, I'm there one day, and they asked me to have a look at the travel site that people would come to the PDC to book their travel on. I go in there, and sure enough, it's the travel site, which a third-party company built, is built using J2EE. I'm like, you can't be serious. We're sending customers. We're telling people that, no, our technology is rock solid. You can bet your business on it. And then we're using the competitive product to book your travel. You know? And I happened to notice it because it aired out, and I saw all the stack trace and everything and that. And I was like, well, not only is it badly designed because it shouldn't be showing errors to customers, it's somebody else's technology. So we had a huge argument about this. And then the senior director that owned the relationship jumps onto the mail thread, and he says something that was absolutely retarded. I just flamed him unmercifully. And I said, look, you know, you're either too stupid to understand what is going on, or the vendor is lying to you. And unbeknownst to me, he had put the vendor on the mail thread. So he then emails me privately, and I was real unhappy. He emails me privately and said, you know, I'm a senior director. You are not treating me with the respect you deserve. And so I took everyone off the original thread, added them back to my reply, and just flamed him again. And so we hold a meeting. He invites me to this meeting. I don't think it's just going to be me and him, much like we're doing here now. We're going to sit down and have a chat. Well, I sit down in this room, and there's this enormously long boardroom table. It's got about 30 seats on it. I sit down, and in he comes with, you know, about 11 or 12 of his own people, and he sits down directly across me, and they sit on either side. It's like I'm a witness at a congressional hearing. And one of these guys starts talking, and he starts talking, and it's like cliche 101. It's like, we want to be all on the same page, and we're hauling the same load, everyone's got to be pulling their oars in the same direction. I'm like, hang on. I look back across this guy, and I say, look, you know, it's, you know, my bus is heading in this direction. You can either get on it or get under it. I don't give a you know, and I went, and I explained how we're going to solve the problem. Well, in walks his VP. His VP walks in, and this is the fun part about it. He had this look on his face. Oh, okay, thanks. The VP's now here, and we can restart the conversation, and he can get his way. What he didn't know is his VP was the guy that hired me back in from IBM. So his VP pokes his head in the door, and I go, and I see him come in. I said, hey, Roski, how are you? He's like, Tone, what's going on? I said, here's what we're going to do. He's like, awesome. Turns, walks straight back out. I look back at this director, and I go, so do you have any further questions on how we're going to solve this problem? And I guess, about 4 weeks later, he's no longer working for the company. So that's my flame story. You know, Visual Studio 2005 and the cast of thousands that were involved in that was an introduction of a bunch of new SKUs for us. And this SKU is one of the great challenges that we have here at Microsoft is that if you go to Albertsons and say, what's a SKU, they will tell you it's like this box, and it's, you know, they order it, they put it in the warehouse, they put it on the shelf. When we say SKU, we mean it's just some set of bits somewhere that may or may not get combined into a product. So we have a bunch of these SKUs, and we're going to release them first time. But that actually wasn't the big thing, per se, about the launch. The big thing in Visual Studio 2005 was the introduction, the two big things, was the introduction of Visual Studio Team System, which provided us an extension of how we provided tools that looked across the developer tool market, and the integration of the .NET framework into SQL Server. And that was a huge thing. You know, the SQL developers, people that build application, build code that it resides in SQL databases, they used to write this stuff in Transact SQL. And Transact SQL as a programming language is something that only a mother can love. It was hard to do. It wasn't a programming language. It didn't have fundamental programming componentry. And so there was an interface on SQL Server that enabled you to create DLLs that would then you could then call as stored procedures, do stuff, come back. And so people were writing in Transact SQL. They were jumping through hoops to go and write these little bits of code and then possibly have to call out into these external DLLs that were written in a completely different language. And then, you know, having that pass back in, and there was no way to debug across them and all this sort of stuff. So we integrated the framework into SQL Server that enabled you then, in the context of the SQL Server database, to write using Visual Basic or C#, and build applications directly, you know, and write the appropriate code. I don't want to get off onto to a discussion about how to segment your application between the business tier, data tiers, client tiers, and so on. The appropriate code needed to be written. But you could go and do that in a language that was much more familiar to you. And then you had the full support of the Visual Studio IDE and debugging capabilities and all that. And that was an awesome amount of work to go and do that. And it created a serial dependency between the framework and SQL Server that also impacted Visual Studio because it had a dependency on the framework in and of itself. So you had this sort of cyclic framework thing going on around and around and around, which leads to a sort of rule tool of the software engineering world. Don't take cyclic dependencies because it's bad for schedules. So that's what we did. That was a lot of work. And that's the major launch for Visual Studio 2005 was a combined launch between SQL Server and Visual Studio. From our side of things, from the VS tooling side of stuff, the SQL stuff was interesting, but really what we did is we launched Visual Studio Team System. And Team System grows us out of our normal area that we were in for the last sort of 15 years. You know, we did great in the, if you think about the software engineering lifecycle, we did great in the build, debug, the code, build, debug part of the cycle. We didn't do much in terms of project management and test and source code management, configuration management, all these things outside of that core experience. So VSTS was the start for us to enter that market and start sharing things out. And the VSTS guys are very, very smart. They sat down, they spent a lot of time thinking about this, and they realized that the challenge that customers had in application lifecycle management wasn't tooling. You know, there were hundreds of vendors that existed that offered requirements management, requirements gathering stuff, project management, test, load test, source code management, all this sort of stuff. The problem was that information flowed between the different roles on a team, like architects, dev, test, project manager, so poorly that impacted people. You know, every developer in the world knows, you know, they've sat in a meeting where the architects have spent years, you know, they've built this wonderful UML diagram of the data entities and how things relate, and it's printed on A3 paper, and it's this enormous thing, and it's color and everything, because they use the expensive plotter to go and make it. And they come and they stick it on the wall, and they say, "Thou shalt bask in the glory of the diagram." And the developers go, "Ooh." And then they go off and code. And that is the last time that diagram is ever accurate. Because the developers sit there and go, "Ooh, you know, these two classes are a performance issue, so we need to combine them together to improve perf." And so they'll do that. Well, now that diagram and what the architects think of the app no longer reflects what's in the actual product. So our VSTS guys sat down and said, well, this is the challenge. How do you flow information between these individual roles? And that was really the market changer for ALM tooling that VSTS delivered, was this ability to have, you know, the diagram that your architect produced would go straight to the developers, and the devs would have that diagram inside Visual Studio. They'd make changes and they'd implement the code, and the code would then apply back to that diagram, and the architect would see the latest diagram, and you could put work items and change information in. And then when you made changes, it would flow to the test people, and they'd be able to see what'd go on. And that was really, I think, a game-changing thing about making this information flow more freely between the individual roles in the software development lifecycle. And then reporting on top of that, the project management aspects, being able to give, you know, your pointy-headed boss a color chart instead of sitting there going, well, the bug rate has decreased by 7% over the last 3 project milestones. You know, you can say, hey, look, line goes down, everyone's a winner. Gaining credibility in the enterprise was, you know, has been challenging, and Team System really did enable us to do that. What we saw was two things. One, there was the inherent problem in that enterprises had roles that we did not have products for. And so when an architect sits there and looks at Visual Studio and he goes, oh, well, there's no architecture ability in Visual Studio, it can't be a serious tool for us to consider. You know, they often wouldn't sit there and go, well, the architecting tool I'm using doesn't actually have any code relationship with the coding tool that we're using today. That didn't matter. It was, a lot of these people were like, Microsoft is not an enterprise player with dev tools, and so therefore it was an ability for them to say no. And another thing was that was companies, would look at our product set and say, well, I can buy this tooling from you, and then I've got to buy this product from this company and this product from this company and so on. And we saw in the actual market space sort of coalescing of companies. IBM acquires Rational. There's HP, does some acquisitions. Mercury Interactive does some acquisitions and things like that. And so you started seeing people saying, well, hey, I can provide you a solution for a broader spectrum of the needs. And so continuing down that path of just having a development tool offering wasn't really successful, or wouldn't really be successful, because enterprises would see that we didn't have their roles covered. And so Team System really did enable us to have more credibility, and it also enabled us to talk the language that a lot of the CIO community uses, application lifecycle manager, software development lifecycle control, how do you deal with integrating your IT professionals into your dev process and this sort of thing, and we can talk the different CMMI levels, we have level threes, level five offerings, we can make them, talk to them about how we do things in languages that they understand, and it really made a huge difference. The fact that we were also radically cheaper than all our competitors didn't have a bad thing to say about success in that space either. And VSTS is one of the hottest topics that I get asked about when I do Executive Briefing Center talks on the next version of Visual Studio. The commentary behind, the next version, or the quality of the next version of the product is always funny. People sort of, they sit there and it's like, well, this version, wasn't particularly good, but no, believe me, the next version will solve the problems. And then the next version comes along and then people say, yeah, okay, this version didn't do everything, but the next version will. And people keep talking about, the next version will do and the next version will do this and so on. And that's why early in product cycles you see marketing people talking about, this was the greatest thing ever. We're going to make this thing and it's going to be so simple it'll have one button. And we're going to push that button for you, right? And the reality is that, no plan survives its first contact. They used to have an old saying in the army that, every battle is fought uphill at night in the rain on the corner of four maps. And that's, the engineering reality is you get there and you have all these great visions for what things are going to do, and then you start running out of time, or the problem space seems to be harder than you thought it was, and you start cutting things. And one of the key aspects of product planning is to ensure that the bits that you're cutting are the right things to cut, in that you have a compelling central offering and you're dealing with a lot of the customer's desires. So in VSTS, in the 2005 release, we entered the market and we provided them with a core set of functionality, and we knew that it didn't cover everything. And customers had, well, what about this, what about this, what about this? And we knew it didn't do that. You have to pick a subset of things to actually go and build and to be able to successfully deliver on that, and that's what we did. We wanted to get into the market and say, here is the product, and it has a set of functionality that we feel very comfortable with, and it really will help you. The next release, in 2008, we continued to expand that functionality. We took a look at a lot of the rough edges. We took a lot of customer feedback, and we said, okay, we want to go and do this and this and this, and we want to make the product broader. We want to do some additional things that customers have asked for it. We want to take those top 10 dissatisfiers, the top 10 requests, and go and cover them so that the product is more compelling. And then we sat down and, looking at the next release of Visual Studio, we did the same thing again. We said, okay, what is the next set of things going to do? And we knew that there were some new roles that we wanted to cover. There were some new things that we needed to do. One of the areas we wanted to extend to was to bring in the non-traditional tester and the project manager more involved into the software development lifecycle. Get the business guy. I build an app and I ship it to a business user, and they basically look at it, they sort of click through it, they go, yeah, it works, it doesn't, and they might give me feedback. Well, why can't I give them a testing tool that they can run the app through and go, yes, here is a bug, I have a problem with this, let me log this directly. But we don't give them a tool like Visual Studio, which has 37,000 bells and whistles on it. That's a tool targeted at a professional developer. Let's give them something that makes it easy for them to use. And so with the next release of Visual Studio, Visual Studio Team System, we'll continue to expand our coverage and continue to look at the roles and things that we want to do, and it will be better. But you don't take that as though I'm going to stick a rosette on the back of the box saying now sucks 28% less. What we're going to do is, it's really about saying, okay, let's find the right things and build them. And I think customers will be very, very happy with VSTS 10. So what can I tell you about VS 2010? Well, it's quite simply, it is the best development tool that anyone can ever buy. In fact, you should buy one for yourself, your mother, and in fact, give them out as Christmas presents. Awesome, awesome. Simply, that's all I can say. So one of the things, VS 10, we really wanted to look at what people did with the tooling and how people built applications. And in the marketplace, there's been a change in how people think of the applications they're building. And one of those areas is around the concept of rich user experience. And traditionally, when you said a rich user experience, if you went back 10, 12 years, maybe even 5, 10 years, when people said rich user experience, they meant a client application. Now when people say rich user experience, it could be a Windows app, or it could be a client application, could be a web application, it could be Flash-based, it could be Silverlight-based. There's some form of rich user experience that the customer has. And we wanted to make Visual Studio 10 a great product for people that are building those types of applications. So one of the significant investment areas is around making it easy for you to build great user experiences in the tooling. The other area is that we wanted to think about the way people actually wrote code and built things. And so if you look at the market, tools have progressively been going along this concept of visual composition and visual design, and there are menus and they're dragging and dropping and things, and I have to get my mouse and I move stuff around. And the market has a major area of people that, I sort of characterize as code-focused developers. These are people that want to live in the code, they want to type, they don't want to be going and moving the mouse around, they don't want to be interacting with their IDE. They want to have their hands on the keyboard, and they want to type and be able to create high-quality code quickly and not have the IDE in the way. And so, we're looking at a lot of what we can do in terms of the developer productivity side of things. We want to move the bar forward, or move the bar up, or ball forward, for the person that does the visual aspect and wants design services and so on. But we really want to go in and address that code-focused developer. In VS 10, there'll be features like that support test-driven development, which is a very common paradigm of development, pattern of development, which has come up over the last few years, around the concepts of being able to consume first, declare second. I'll be able to go and write my tests and have my classes and objects and consume them and write a good test and have the IDE implement for me in the background all of the declaration I need to before I actually go in and write my coding. And then obviously we have to support the next wave of platform stuff. There's a Windows 7 is coming out. There are new versions of Office and our server platforms. There's next version of Silverlight's coming out. There's a whole heap of stuff that we want to go and support. And so we'll be doing a ton of work inside there to support these new application platforms and some of the new features that are in those. A great example is multi-touch. In Windows 7, there's this concept of being able to put multiple points on a touch-sensitive screen and deal with the multiple touch points. And we'll support that inside Windows Presentation Foundation, and the IDE will be able to take advantage of that and support all that work. So people will build these applications and they'll be able to look at these new platforms and say, okay, I can use this new feature and this new feature and that. And so doing all of that is a lot of, again, a lot of work inside the environment. And we're also doing some what we would term code hygiene work. There's stuff around going in and updating the development environment. We've completely ripped out the editor, and we've put a new editor in that's built on WPF that gives us a bunch of new functionality, makes building extensions easier and all this sort of stuff. So we went and around that way, invested in some of these things, which may not necessarily give you a parity delta, but they certainly change the baseline and make it easier for people to do things than what they've had previously.